Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Rain Ryle Adamson. Mr. Adamson is the appellant. For the appellant is Mr. Michael Butler, a Sioux Falls attorney, and for the appellee state is Ms. Sherry Sundenwald, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Butler, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. In this appeal, the question presented here is...
Stop a minute. We have a technical malfunction. We need another pen here. Shirley, could you go get a pen, please? Thank you. Okay. Sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Butler, but you didn't lose any time. So, once again, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The question in this appeal is, when does conduct... alleged conduct rise to the level of criminal tampering with witnesses? I think it is important from the outset, at least for me, to address what I believe under the statute is not witness tampering. Contacting a witness without more is not witness tampering under the statute. Contacting a witness and asking a witness to not testify alone is not witness tampering under the statute. Contacting a witness and promising them a benefit for not testifying, standing alone, is not witness tampering. The law requires that you have an intent to have testimony either made falsely to a grand jury or withheld from a grand jury, in this case grand jury, I'm sorry, but an official proceeding. And that you do something to accomplish that or to effectuate that. You can threaten them if you testify, I'll do this or that. Or you can confer a benefit, which is what is alleged in this case. If you'll do a certain thing, I'll give to you a certain thing in exchange for that. The reason I take the time to point out here that witness contacts or begging a witness or pleading with a witness to not testify under our statute, standing alone is not a crime. Now, I'm not suggesting that's what went on here, but I think it is important because I think sometimes there's a perception that if you get a hold of a witness and you say, are you going to testify to the grand jury? Well, what are you going to tell them? Are you going to say it happened? If you do it, you'll ruin my life. Will that fall under a category of obstructing justice? I don't know. Maybe there's an argument that it does. But it's not witness tampering. We need to look at the elements and what the facts are alleged here to see if it is, as South Dakota writes the law, which is the benefit, as was alleged in this case, and in exchange for what? The quid pro quo. In this case, the government alleges the same essential facts as to the mother, Susan Ballison, the daughter, A.B. The daughter, A.B., it was alleged, had a sexual encounter with the defendant, Rain Adamson, sometime in the summer of 2005. Subsequently, A.B. reported, shortly after she said she did, that it never happened. A recantation or a retraction of the allegation. This would be in August 12th, approximately in that time frame, and September 9th is our grand jury. During that time, at the trial, the government presents no evidence from A.B. except to call her twice as a witness in the trial, to ask her on one occasion her age, where she lives, and whether she knew the defendant. On a second occasion, to identify a cell phone number. At no time did the government ever ask her whether she was involved in any kind of a relationship, whether she had phone calls with Mr. Adamson, nothing of any substance.
How old was she at the time of trial?
15, I believe, and I believe 14 maybe during the time of the allegation. I may be wrong, 14 for sure, I believe, during the time frame of the allegation, but possibly 15 when it was tried, Your Honor.
Is there any relevance to the fact the jury acquitted on the sex charges?
In my opinion, it's this. I think we had jury nullification in reverse. I think it was, well, the reason we can't prove the rape is because of what the defendant was up to, and therefore we'll convict him of the tampering. That's truly how I perceive it, because, again, we have to set aside A.B. in this case because she never testified to anything. So the principal witness, her mother, is called as a state witness. She testifies that she contacted Mr. Adamson on three separate occasions between roughly the 12th of August and the time the grand jury met and the 9th of September. She believes she initiated the first call to him. And in that call, she says, my daughter is saying now it didn't happen. And she said that she initiated the call. She says she wanted to meet the state, asked her in cross. Well, is it possible he called? And she said, well, I suppose it's possible, but I think I called him. Regardless, they have one meeting outside of town on a gravel road, a place called, I think, Double Bridges, at which time she said she conveys to him, she's saying it didn't happen. What should I do? I don't know what to do. According to her testimony, he called his attorney and spoke to him after speaking with his attorney, and for the record, it wasn't me at that time, but after speaking with his attorney, then said to her, you need to get her an attorney, checked against a false reporting charge if she goes to testify. And he also, according to her testimony, Susan, he said, go tell the police that she's saying it didn't happen now. The mother calls, and it comes down to this Desert Rose Inn, the local bar owned by the Adamson family in Centerville, and has a second conversation about getting a lawyer. Now, this is literally a matter of a day or two preceding the grand jury. She says that Mr. Adamson helped her looking in the phone book to find legal counsel for her daughter. They each made calls, but the call that she made that resulted in retention of an attorney was the one she placed to a gentleman, Grant Elvine, of Sioux Falls. According to her, she wanted the lawyer for her daughter because of her concern that if her daughter went in and testified, nothing ever happened, that there could be legal consequences or ramifications of that. According to her testimony, Mr. Elvine said, I need $500 to be retained, in which she said at some point, she told Mr. Adamson, I don't have $500. Would you loan or borrow me the money? He agrees to do that and gives her $500 cash from the video lottery machines, I believe he testified to. Mr. Elvine was hired. Mr. Elvine, according to a pretrial hearing, for the record at least, apparently placed some call to the state's attorney trying to negotiate immunity for his client if she would come in and testify. That was in a pretrial hearing on a motion to quash a subpoena made to Mr. Elvine, Mr. Doug Hawkins, who follows representing him at that. No immunity was given. Mr. Elvine accompanied the young lady to the grand jury proceedings, and when they arrived at the points of the critical questions, she took the Fifth on the advice of counsel, who was present with her at the time, taking the Fifth, I assume, because of concerns about the false report. This, the government says, is witness tampering. It is witness tampering because the $500 loan was made, and it's witness tampering because Mr. Adamson intended to have evidence withheld. And I want to address both. First, as to Susan Dallas. The government never argues and never points to any single piece of evidence in which it attempts to prove or show what exactly or how and in what fashion was Ms. Dollison influenced to give false testimony or to withhold testimony. She testified to the grand jury and then testified again at trial. If you go to the testimony of her, which I've outlined in page 10 of the brief, I think in relevant part, I went through a series of questions with Ms. Ballison. Did he promise you something? Did he offer something? Was he going to do this? No, 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 no. And I asked with regard to your daughter, did he promise or give something, did he, et cetera. No to all of that. She said, I wanted a lawyer for my daughter, and I was afraid for her.
What did the indictment say, which witness he was charged with tampering with?
Susan, and then A.B., and then another young lady named Rochelle Kelson. That was a motion for judgment of acquittal was granted as to that count, because the state was arguing there that his friendship was enough of a benefit to her, and even the judge wouldn't accept that.
So there was separate counts for each witness?
Right.
And the jury found him guilty of two counts, the mother and the daughter?
Right. Okay. Now, on Susan Ballison, their witness says, nothing was ever asked of me. Nothing was ever asked of me to withhold anything or to testify falsely. The government in this case has never alleged she did. So we have no evidence in the record that would support that conclusion. And I think to illustrate the point, I would like to note that the trial court responding to arguments on the motion for judgment of acquittal said to the state's attorney, in part, page 230, 231 of the trial transcript, and he says to about the young lady and about Susan Ballison, but he says, but as a conduit under count 8, I mean, I don't think you are even explaining where there was an attempt to induce Susan to testify falsely. Because she was just really a conduit for A.B. having the information. And when you read the colloquy that went on during there, it's obvious the trial court is having quite a little difficulty grasping the theory of the tampering charge based on the fact that the mother borrowed or took $500 to hire Mr. Alvine. There was no evidence introduced at the trial that the mother ever communicated to A.B. that the defendant borrowed me $500 so I can get you a lawyer. The mother took her daughter to Mr. Alvine. At that point, she had legal counsel, and he appeared with her. But so, anyway, as to Susan, I want to stay back. I'd ask you to go back and look, and in particular at the final arguments as well on page 283, where the state is summarizing its proof as to my client's intent to influence her. As to A.B. on page 279 as well, it argues what its relevant proof is on the material element. And when you read it, you're left down to this whole thing of we're not talking inferences now. We're talking about speculation. You know, the law recognizes at times there's legitimate, rational inferences from the evidence that may be drawn. But when you are left to just speculate as to whatever you want occurred, but we, the government, thinks this is what occurred, I don't think that is permissible, and I believe that's what occurred in this case. The sequence of events is very important here as well, and in that respect, I want to address, a disagreement I have with the state's rendition a little bit on the record here. When Susan Dollison's daughter, according to the testimony at trial, came to her mother in August of 05 and said, I was told by someone that A.B. had sex with Rain. Mother, at that point, as the evidence of the trial would say, she was somewhat intoxicated, went down, looked for Mr. Addison, had a conversation and confrontation with him downtown. And she testified about those facts, some of which could be argued that they were inculpatory, and the state surely did, which is another reason I suggest why the state's never argued Mr. Addison tried to influence her, because she gave inculpatory testimony about him to the grand jury as well as the trial. But then, according to the evidence, here's what's not clear. At what point this young lady had a conversation with the law enforcement officer that evening. And that evening in the car, at some point in the conversation, she denies, and then she says it happened. And then later, apparently that same evening, says, no, it didn't happen. Now, one thing the state writes, and the reason I say this is important, is this precedes by literally weeks before the mother goes and makes a decision to hire a lawyer. And when you're considering under the statute, was there a quid pro quo? In other words, was there a point in time at which it says, ma'am, I'm going to hire you a lawyer if you get your daughter to recant? You see, the recantation was, according to the evidence, literally on the same, apparently within 24 hours or less time. Well, that was totally separate and apart, and weeks before there was any discussion about whether she should get a legal counsel and the $500. There wasn't, as you might say, in contract law, consideration. I mean, the two critical events are not in, I think, are not in pertinent sequence when you want to say one in exchange for the other, even if you assume it was him that got her to recant or whether she recanted on her own. But because they never asked the young lady about any of this, of course, there is no testimony on those points. So, and here's the other question I think that comes into play here is the government's whole theory is because the mother got the money, the daughter realized a benefit, the mother realized a benefit, and then they simply say, as to the mother, you must speculate as to how she was influenced and what the defendant intended to do, although there was no evidence of what, other than to borrow her the money. But here's the other important thing I said, I think is, needs to be addressed. AB has no knowledge, no evidence suggests AB is knowledgeable that the accused borrowed $500 to her mom. There's nothing in the record, no proof that says that the young lady was informed, I got $500 from you. The benefit is, I get to get you a lawyer. You know, then if implicitly you'll do something in exchange for it. There's no evidence the daughter was aware of it. So now the question becomes, under this theory the state advanced, can you be conferring a benefit in order to influence testimony when the person's testimony you want to influence is not knowledgeable of the conference of the benefit? I think you have to have some awareness in order to make the connection to elevate it to a crime that I was told if I do a certain thing, not be entirely candid, withhold evidence, whatever that may be, I got an expectation, either a fear of something happening or an expectation of a benefit occurring. But it's directly connected factually between the two. There's no evidence here that that occurred.
What about the evidence of Rochelle? And I understand that count was thrown out, but as I understand the record, she testified as to both herself and the juvenile.
She did.
And you point out in your brief that she was impeached on that. But if she testified that there was some kind of influence attempt here, and you impeach on it, isn't the case over as far as our standard of review? I mean, then it was for the jury to make the decision.
Again, this still goes back to the question as let's assume for discussion purposes they accepted what she said. He came up and said, we need to have a staged phone call. So then what I raise here is really, if you accept it, and again, you're right, she was impeached on certain critical aspects of it, but if you accept it, you say, has the state established that what he did was being done in exchange for what? That later down the road you'd hire a lawyer? And that's why I made the critical point I did, Justice Sinner, I think at the beginning. If I go and I say to someone, you got to give me an alibi, I'm in big trouble, you say I'm over here, okay. That's not witness tampering. Under our statute, I have to give something for it or threaten something from it. What I'm saying is, even if you assume this guy went to this Rochelle Kelsey, if you accept it as truth, and said what he said, it's still missing the quid pro quo, the exchanged benefit. The fact that, again, later on, apparently weeks later, the mother decided to hire the lawyers, what they claim is the benefit for what? Mr. Adamson going to someone and saying, get her to say it didn't happen. And so I think the sequence and the timing of events, even if you want to take that and accept it is extremely important here. But I want you to contrast this to something real quick, and I'm going to cover my one other thing in the last minute and a half. But consider this. My client is accused of witness tampering because he gave the mother of this girl $500 to hire an attorney. It's undisputed in the record. The day before the testimony, the state's attorney, Ms. Hookie, lead agent Jim Severson, went to the mother's house and said to her, along with the chief of police, Nolan Clark, if your daughter goes to the grand jury tomorrow and testifies differently than what she told me, Jim Severson, you face charges of child abuse and or neglect, and you can lose your daughter. And as this lady testified, were you intimidated? Yes. Threatened? Yes. Afraid? Yes. And you've got the state's attorney sitting in the office, and this guy sitting in the office says, we're going to take your daughter from you if you testify differently tomorrow. My client said, go hire a lawyer, and he's serving 8 years. How come they get away with that stuff? And I think if you truly have evidence of somebody trying to improperly influence and threaten and intimidate a witness, it happened by the state. Before my time runs on the discovery, I want to say this. The critical evidence in the case for me was supplied less than 1 week, phone records. Why was it important? Because not one witness got up and testified about what occurred in any of those phone conversations that they allegedly had as to the contents of the phone conversations. That's why its late discovery was highly prejudicial to the defense. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Ms. Sundermall, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Sherry Sundenwald. I'm Assistant Attorney General for the state. As defense counsel noted, defendant was convicted of 2 counts of tampering with a witness, along with 1 count of furnishing alcohol to a minor and 1 count of furnishing alcohol to a person over 18 but under the age of 21. I think the facts here are very important. The two victims in this case, in terms of witness tampering, are A.B., who was 14 at the time of the offense, as the jury found an offense had occurred, and her mother, Susan. The facts, as set out on the record, show that A.B. met defendant through her 18-year-old friend, Rochelle. This was in the summer of 2005. These girls would frequently stay at Rochelle's and drink alcohol. The testimony established, and Rochelle admitted that they did a lot of drinking that summer. Rochelle testified that on one particular evening, the first weekend in August, which I believe is the 5th and 6th of August, if my dates are correct, defendant came over to Rochelle's house, and he brought screwdrivers and he brought beer to the girls. He came there after A.B. used Rochelle's cell phone and text him and asked him to bring alcohol from the bar that Rat Adamson's owned, the Desert Inn. About 11, 12 o'clock, defendant came over there with 4 screwdrivers, and Rochelle was very specific in her description of those screwdrivers, in a 6-pack container, little plastic cup with a lid and straws. He left and he came back about 2:30, 3 o'clock, I guess you can assume after the bar closed, and he brought another screwdriver and I think some beer. And the testimony established that defendant A.B., Rochelle, and her boyfriend, Adam Solberg, sat around a bonfire and drank till about 3:30 in the morning. Rochelle and her boyfriend leave, and before Rochelle leaves, she goes up to A.B. and says, don't leave with him, you stay at my house tonight. The testimony, according to Rochelle, was that A.B. didn't listen to Rochelle, and in the morning, Rochelle is woke by somebody at the door pounding on her door. She doesn't want to answer the door because she thinks it might be Susan looking for her daughter. What does Rochelle do? She calls over to defendant's house. Defendant lives across the street from where Rochelle is living. Talks to A.B. and says, you get home. You get back here. Somebody's here looking for you. And within a few minutes, A.B. is there, and she has the same clothing on she wore the night before. It takes about a week. And A.B.'s sister, Diana, comes to Rochelle and says, how come you didn't answer the door? That was me that was knocking on the door. It wasn't my mom, it was me. And Diana says, because I thought it was your mom, and A.B. was over at defendant's home. And Diana was tuned in to something happening because she looked through the door of Rochelle's home and she noticed that her sister's shoes weren't there, and evidently there was an unspoken rule that you don't wear your shoes in Rochelle's house. And that's what caused her to ask, where was A.B.? That's when the things begin to happen. This is August 12th. Diana goes and tells her mom, reports to her mom what she's learned from Rochelle. Her mother, Susan, is upset. She directs Diana to help her find the defendant. They go to Centerville looking for him because Susan says, I didn't know who he was. Diana had to point him out to me. Susan confronts the defendant. Diana says she's there to hear the entire transaction of events. Defendant at that point admits that he's had sex with A.B. to Susan and Diana. Later he discounts that and says, I never said that. He says something, though, I think is very strange. I won't be seeing her until she's 16. This is the former chief of police of Centerville. He's a former law enforcement officer, and he's saying he told this young girl he couldn't see her until she was 16. He knows he's concerned, however. So what does he do? He goes and he finds, well, and then Diana, excuse me, I'm getting ahead of myself. What happens then? He goes and Diana and Susan go and find the chief of police, Nolan Clark, and they report what they've learned from the defendant. Nolan Clark goes to talk to the defendant. By then, his story has changed a little. It's not that I had sex with her. He says, I told her, I knew she had a crush. I mean, I told her I couldn't see her until she was 16. Odd statement for a former chief of police to say about a young lady. What happens next? About 1:30, defendant calls the chief of police. This is after, of course, the chief of police has talked to the defendant. And he is the first to tell the chief of police that A.B. and Susan are going to change their story. This is after Nolan has heard that that there's allegations that A.B. has had sex with the defendant. A.B., of course, has met with the chief of police and has admitted, yeah, I had sex with him. Now, all of a sudden, by 1:30, her story is changing. How is it that defendant was the first person who knew that their story was going to change? There's a lot of transactions that start to occur, and that's where these telephone records are.
So I understand the record that occurred before any benefit was allegedly given. Correct?
Well, any benefit that's specifically on the record, the $500 certainly had not been given at that time.
Well, we have to. Isn't that the only theory of the case, the $500?
And I think the friendship aspect in reference to A.B. A.B. and defendant certainly had a friendship.
The fact that the story's changing doesn't really mean anything if the benefit hadn't been given at that point.
Well, in reference to, I think it's a long drawn out chain of events. By the time that phone call comes to the chief of police, Rochelle had testified that defendant had come to her and asked her to relay a message to A.B. And the message was, tell A.B. she needs to lie, she needs to call and make up a story, she needs to change her story, she needs to lie and get me out of trouble. That conversation had already occurred between defendant and Rochelle. And the state's theory of the case was that Rochelle was the conduit between conversations between defendant and A.B.
Do you agree that if it were just the phone calls with that message that it wouldn't meet the statutory requirements of witness tampering without the $500?
No, Your Honor, I'm not prepared to go there. We obviously have the $500. But the benefit, obviously money is an easy benefit to see, but I don't know that that was the entire benefit that the state alleged.
So what other benefit was there?
Well, I think there was a benefit to A.B. in terms of she obviously wanted to continue this friendship or whatever relationship she had with the defendant.
And that's enough to meet the statutory requirement?
I don't know that it isn't enough, depending on the facts of the case.
What evidence do you have about the friendship thing? Was that before the
jury, or
is that just speculation?
Well, there's lots of phone calls that are going on. Back and forth. I think that's where the phone calls are important. There's obviously a relationship that's continuing somewhere. And it's crucial to look at the times of those phone calls. When do they occur? They occur primarily August 12th and 13th, when the initial report is given in reference to the sexual encounters. There's August 23rd when DCI is coming to the Centerville area to interview the witnesses, Rochelle, Susan, AB. Lots of phone calls occurring then. September 8th and 9th, right before the grand jury convenes. There's a lot going on here.
Now, just so that because I got confused on the phone calls. To who were they actually made to? Now, some of them were to Rochelle, and she testified about that, or what?
Certainly, Rochelle's cell phone was used. And there is testimony in the record that AB used Rochelle's cell phone. She used Rochelle's cell phone to text the defendant to bring drinks the night of the party.
But this 12th and 13th dates, I guess, is what I'm looking at. Who else were those phone calls to?
I think there's the 12th and 13th, the phone calls are primarily from defendant to the Ballison residence in the middle of the night. And that's when that star 67 feature is used. That occurs from the 8th through the 12th. And then there's also phone calls from defendant to Rochelle. Okay. There are phone calls to the Ballison residence in the middle of the night primarily. And then the others are from defendant to Rochelle's cell phone.
Okay, and in the trial, who testified about the contents of any of those phone calls? Did anyone testify about the contents of them?
The only testimony involving contents of phone conversations came from Susan and Rochelle, and they certainly did not cover the entire gamut of the conversations that occurred, as set forth in State's Exhibit 6. There are a lot of conversations where, yes, you're correct, Justice Meyer Henry, there is no testimony sorting out what occurred during the course of those conversations. That is correct. There is testimony from Rochelle that AB used her cell phone to text the defendant and ask him to bring alcohol on the evening. I think it would be the 5th or the 6th, depending on what time that occurred. Rochelle talked about a phone call. She had a few phone calls, she said, with defendant, one of which he called her. I believe that was after the DCI came to Centerville to interview the three women, and he wanted to know what kinds of questions they were asking. I think there's another conversation where a defendant contacted Rochelle and wanted to know the whereabouts of AB, what she was doing, if she had been seen by Rochelle. Susan testified to a couple of phone calls with the defendant in reference to trying to figure out what they were going to do about the fact that AB was changing her story. That's the crux of the testimony involving conversations that occurred even though we have pages.
Which isn't enough in itself to prove tampering, is it? If they're discussing what somebody's going to testify to, I would hope not.
I don't think anybody has ever suggested that the phone calls are enough to establish tampering. We don't disagree that talking to a witness in and of itself is not tampering, but there's so much more here. You have Rochelle testifying that she was asked to relay a message, and she relayed that message to AB saying, recant your story. Call and recant your story. And, of course, AB makes a phone call saying, it didn't happen, I was mad, so I made this up, and we never had sex. Of course, you also have Rochelle testifying in the events of that evening when AB left her house and went over to defendant's house and was at defendant's house until the next morning.
What about Mr. Butler's response of the sequence and the quid pro quo regarding Rochelle's testimony? There really isn't, at the time this occurred, there'd been no offer of the attorney or the money.
In terms of the tampering with the witness, obviously that is part of the big picture in terms of what happened at the grand jury. What happened at the grand jury, AB appears and pleads the 5th, and that was before the money was, and that was after the money had been offered. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but the crucial time is before the grand jury when she does not testify but pleads the fifth. AB pleads the fifth. That's the state's position, because certainly AB had made some statements and she now had changed her story. It's the state's position she changed her story at the urging and at the request of the defendant, and that's what she did, as did Susan. And of course, keep in mind, our statute does not require that the false testimony actually be offered. It only requires that there be an intent on the part of the defendant to influence that witness in some way and to offer, confer a benefit. And it's the state's position that that occurred in this case.
Does the benefit have to be conferred contemporaneously? That's the question. Or can it be conferred? Can the request be made at one time and then the benefit be given much later?
I think it can. I haven't certainly seen anything from this court that requires that the two be simultaneously done. It's the state's
quid pro quo usually contemplates simultaneous exchange. But here there doesn't appear to be one, at least not visible.
I have not seen anything in this court's case law that requires that kind of quid pro quo exchange. Here we've certainly got defendant offering to pay for an attorney, either a gift or a loan. It can be either one. The crucial aspect to this in the state's perspective is defendant wanted AB to go to the authorities and change her story. Mom said, I'm afraid to have her do that unless I see an attorney first. So it was in the defendant's best interest to make sure that AB and Susan went to the authorities, and the way they were going to have that happen was to help them get money to pay for an attorney. Otherwise, why did he care? Why did he care if she was changing her story? Why were there these meetings on gravel roads and in parking lots? What did it matter other than there was something there? There was a concern certainly on the defendant's part. He wanted them to change the story, and he was going to do what he needed to do to get that done.
Let's assume for the moment that, I mean, this happens often, that somebody may tell one story and then actually recanted that it didn't happen. Do you have to get into that at all here on which story was the accurate story when you're talking about witness tampering? I mean, children or people have gone to the police, false reported, and then later recanted. Now, where does that fit in your theory then? Is it then we always take what they told the police first as the story? And if it's asked to be changed and they changed it, then it's witness tampering? Do we ever get into having to decide which story was the accurate story in order to determine whether it was witness tampering?
I don't know that they do, but the jury certainly had in front of them the fact that Rochelle testified about the events of the evening of August 5th or 6th, and that AB went with defendant. We have the
test. She would have not known what happened
exactly in that
house across the street.
Right,
and you have here the alleged victim who never testified.
That's correct. The state did not put her on the stand because they didn't think she was going to testify truthfully, and they felt they had an ethical obligation not to put her on the stand if she wasn't going to offer truthful testimony. But you also have the statements from the defendant to Susan, the mother, and to Diana. Diana testified that she heard that testimony. Obviously, there was some conflicting testimony there, but Diana and Susan both testified that they heard defendant admit that he had sex with AB. What he said is, I thought she was 16, the legal age of consent in South Dakota. And then when he determined she wasn't 16, he told Chief Nolan Clark that he had told her, I know she has a crush on me, but I told her I couldn't date her until she was 16. So within a short amount of time, his story had changed. At least the jury was free to believe that. And the jury heard all this testimony. And obviously the jury acquitted him of the rape charges. You could presume that's because they didn't hear from the victim, AB. But what they did hear is the testimony surrounding the long chain of events that led up to the grand jury.
How do you sustain a conviction for witness tampering with a witness who is not a witness? For example, Susan, Mr. Butler argues that she was not a witness. How do you sustain that conviction?
Well, Susan was the witness. A.B. was not the witness. And, of course, it's the state's position that she wasn't a witness because of the tampering. Had she not been tampered with, she would have testified as to the facts surrounding the events leading up to the rape charge.
Now, A.B. was the witness.
A.B. is the 14-year-old young lady.
Right. She would have been the witness that supposedly they tampered with her testimony, right?
Her testimony along with the mother, Susan's. The jury convicted the defendant of both counts.
What was the mother the witness to?
The mother was the witness to the conversation with the defendant when she first found out that her daughter had been with the defendant, and the defendant admitted to her that he had had sex with her daughter.
Now, did she testify to that, or did she deny that?
She testified to that. And then she certainly testified that that's what the defendant said, but then in cross-examination, she said he was answering a lot of questions. His answer was yes, it may have been to another question I posed. She had been drinking, but Diana was there, the daughter. She was, I thought, adamant in her position that the defendant admitted that he had had sex with A.B. There was also room to attack her credibility because she'd been in a car accident. She has some memory issues. But these are, as Justice Zinner noted earlier, these are all questions for the jury.
But what, so that I understand here, what did she change her story to because of the tampering? Susan?
Susan, she was...
She testified to that conversation where he admitted it. Where did she change her story because of the tampering?
Well, I think you can have tampering without her having to change her story. Tampering goes to the intent of the defendant and what he's asking the witnesses to do. They don't have to testify falsely to have witness tampering under our statute.
Then answer that question. What was he asking her to do? Susan.
He was asking her to get an attorney for the daughter, and he paid for the attorney so that the daughter would change her story.
Your time has expired. Thank you. Mr. Butler, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Justice Konenkamp, I'd like to address a point, at least initially, that you raised, which is the whole, I guess, the question of how contemporaneous do the two events have to be, the conference of the benefit and the request to withhold or the threat, whatever it may be. I don't know that I would not argue there's a precise formula at all. But what I would argue is this. One has to know that they're getting the benefit in order to be influenced by the benefit. If I don't know somebody is doing something for my benefit, then you can't say it influenced me. For example, I got to believe there are lots of times in court battles where someone is thinking something in their mind. If that person goes into that court and says that, I'm going to go over and brain them. They don't do anything to communicate that to the person. It's not witness tampering. The proof in this case that is utterly absent, they want to take the event they set on the night in question. The state says Mr. Adamson got her to change her story. And then 3 weeks later, when had a discussion with the mother, he loaned her $500. And they say that's the witness tampering. I know Ms. Sonnenwald today wants to say, well, we also had friendship and goodwill. That was not the case at the trial, and I'd ask you not to accept that now. They should adhere to the theory of the case they presented to the jury, which was $500. They tried to use the argument to the trial court on Rochelle Kelson that it was this continued friendship that influenced her. You know, that becomes such a subjective road to start to go down that we're going to say someone's continued friendship is sufficient to satisfy the conference of a benefit element of the offense. But we don't need to go here today because they said it's the 500. We argued that to the court, and the court let it go to the jury on that point. And the fact is, they can't connect the two events. And as I said before, what I think you have here is what amounts to jury nullification in reverse. They just thought the evidence is suggestive here. He was talking to witnesses, and he's trying to do that, and that's not right, and we're going to nail him. Now, the state makes a point, and I take issue with it, and I want to address it in my brief. They continue to say that on the evening that the young lady was interviewed by the law enforcement officer, and when she said initially, first she says it didn't, then she says it did, and then later that night the state says Mr. Adamson called the law enforcement officer and said she's changed her mind. And the state argues in its brief on page 21 that Mr. Adamson had already gone to Rochelle Kelson and said, please have AB place this staged phone call. And last paragraph, they say, defendant called Chief Clark after he approached Rochelle and asked her to relay a message to AB, instructing AB to lie and, quote, make a staged phone call, close quote, so defendant would not get in trouble. And it cites 77 and 78 of the trial transcript, 86-92. That's not there, and that was never testified to. It was never, the evidence, and you can go look yourself in the record or whoever would do that, but that was not the testimony at trial that occurred the same evening. When you read the transcript of that, Ms. Kelson says earlier in the evening she had a conversation with the defendant, and then when Nolan Clark came up to do interviews, and then she's asked, well, when's the next time you saw him? I saw him on the porch. Next time I saw him was again on the porch on an evening. She never, it's not said that all this happened, boom, boom, boom. As they are arguing, and I would only ask that before you accept that representation of fact as true, I encourage you to check those references in the brief, because I don't see that there. I want to briefly, in my time, there was discussion about these phone calls and what they mean. And Judge Meyer Henry, you had said, did anybody testify about the contents? And as you know, I raised in the brief this very issue about the phone records I received 1 week before trial. And the state has argued that two things in that respect. One is that it had given notice to the defense that they intended to use phone records well in advance of trial. The response to that is yes, but they didn't specify phone numbers, and the record in this case shows they turned over phone records from the Desert Rose Inn well in advance, several months in advance of trial. The next phone records, which they relied heavily on in the closing arguments and in their evidence to suggest the witness tampering, was my client's cell phone records, which they provided 1 week before trial, 8 months after the case started. The argument they gave at that point was, well, the reason we're late is we discovered that Mr. Adamson had kept the same number but had a different cell phone provider, and that's the reason we're late. I argued to the trial court that they shouldn't be allowed to get the evidence in. The trial court accepted the state's argument that so long as they're his phone calls, he ought to know what's in them, therefore no prejudice. Two things I'd like to say to them. We had pretrial hearings December 7th, January 18th, April 12th, and April 26th. The trial commenced May 1st. Not once did the state come in saying it was having trouble getting cell phone records. There was no claim then we may need a delay in the trial. The state's having trouble getting evidence. They asked for a delay to get the DNA results in, but they didn't come in and say we're having trouble finding evidence. I was right here in this courtroom on April 24th of last year, or the 23rd, 24th, I drove back to Sioux Falls, and I had all of these records in my facts 1 week before the trial, 114 pages. And that's when I filed the motion. Now, when you go back and look at those records, the government argued then, and they would argue now, that all kinds of inferences can be drawn. I would argue this. Many of those phone calls were 14 seconds, 30 seconds, 60 seconds. I tried to ask their witness the question, well, does that mean the person was on hold, that they left a message, or they had a conversation? Don't know. So when you go back and look, when the judge tells us we're supposed to know what our cell phone records mean, does 30 seconds mean I had a 20-second conversation, or does it mean I waited for 30 seconds till somebody picked the phone up? And I asked, I told the judge, give me time. You shouldn't let me, but give me time to find out. Find out, was my client using the phone? Find out, was the other person? Big Justice Meyer Henry asked the question, who got the phone calls? Now, the proper question is, what number were they made to? Not who. Because they never offered evidence, particularly as to AB, any phone contacts with her. They didn't ask her anything. The state says that these girls, there's some testimony or something that sometimes these girls use each other's phones. I think young girls do that sometimes. They share phones. But had we had time, could we have gone in and perhaps find out, because their witness didn't know, whether 90 seconds was a leaving a message or 60 seconds or 30 seconds. And yet they go in and they say, these phone calls prove he's up to no good. And maybe they do, maybe they don't. But you had nothing but a piece of paper saying that with no opportunity to, I think, meaningfully cross-examine and meaningfully investigate. You know, a lot of drug cases where you see phone records are utilized. They're utilized to corroborate a witness. Witness A gets up and he says, I called to arrange for a purchase from Mr. Drug Dealer. You're handed the record. When did you make that call? You know, 3:30 in the morning. Okay, phone records back you up. So we're giving him credibility. Here it wasn't. They put it on the wall and they said, we're not going to ask anybody about these conversations, but we want you, members of the jury, to find them as proof to witness tampering. But at least give me more than a week when you've had 8 months. And if you look at their closing argument, they rely quite heavily on those phone records to prove their case, because nobody gets up and says what they want them to say. Susan Ballison says, no attempts to influence me or my daughter other than I got the $500. Nothing from the daughter. Nothing that the daughter was even ever aware of the getting the lawyer and how all of that worked. This case I am presenting is truly a legal argument. In all senses of this, it's not about does something not look right. It's about whether proof has been made, not only factually, but under the law. And what we've done in this case is we've taken two events that have not been shown to be connected. The claim that she changed her story because Mr. Adamson told her to, which she's never said, has been... that's not what's proven. But secondly, that 3 or 4 weeks later, when there's $500 exchanged to hire a lawyer, that in order to get her to do what she did 3 weeks earlier, 3 weeks later, about $500 to the mother to go hire a lawyer. I believe that's a stretch beyond the law, no matter how you choose to interpret the facts of the case. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.